Hello and welcome to Talking Architects. I'm your host, Matt Deacon. Quality attributes as first-class citizens of a project. Something that many of us could only really dream of. But Len Bass of the SEI thinks he has a way of making this happen. Quality attributes, he suggests, are the only way to drive architectural decisions effectively. And quality attribute-based use case scenarios offer the key to their successful delivery. I started off by asking Len whether we are just too focused on function.
If you take any kind of design course, these days it's better, but at least 5 years ago, if you took any kind of design course in university, you were taught object-oriented design. Mm. And what happens in object-oriented design is you think about functions and the various functionalities fit together, and you try and identify objects. And if you think about the reason for that is that you're trying to make things more easier to modify. Mm. That's why you put things that are coherent together. Yeah. And so that's actually a special case of the notion of thinking about quality as a driver. It's just that you focused on one particular quality, which has this intimate relationship with functionality. But if you look at the kinds of problems that people have in building systems, it tends to be things like performance and security and availability. And these are the things that the architects spend their time worrying about and that end up in most of the design decisions that you see.
Yeah, and for sure the architects has always been thinking about those issues, but to sell them into the development teams, the whole project as a whole, to get them as line items on a project manager's list is
difficult. Yes,
exactly. So really what struck me with what you were saying was actually by turning this around and from the architect's perspective, actually driving those through, then you can actually potentially get them onto the sort of project management map. And dealt with through the life cycle of the project as a sort of first class citizen.
And that's kind of been the driving motivation for the SEI work for the last 10 years now is to make quality attributes first class citizens. Mm. It's a nice way of formulating it, and especially if you can get the various stakeholders to express what they think are important.
Mm. So that brought me. That was the next thing you went into. So. What was really neat was the fact that, okay, you've got these quality attributes, but you can't categorize them, or they're not discrete in that sense, that non-functional requirements go across many, and that led you to these scenarios.
Yeah.
So I know you can't explain it
So my sense is that at some point in the future we'll have an orthogonal set of quality attributes that will enable us to say that this fits in this point in the space, but at the moment they're all kind of intertwined. So if you look at something like response time, is that a usability problem or a performance problem? The answer is both. So you can't really categorize it in those kinds of things. And so what we ended up doing, instead of talking about performance, we talked about scenarios. Mm-hmm. So it has the same relationship as use cases have to a functional description, which is here's a special instance of that. This is what I think is important, and as an architect, you have to look at that as a representative of a class rather than, being an instance in its own its own right. And so that enables you to design with some level of generality. But the first step is to realize that quality attributes are important and they drive the design. The second step is to formulate the quality attributes specifically enough so that they can be tested. Mm. And that's the purpose of the quality attribute scenarios that we talked about.
Yeah, no, that's intriguing because once you've got to that stage, then they can be driven through and you've got an audit trail of how they've been delivered on.
Yeah, once you can get them written down and prioritized.
Yeah, so the other sort of towards the end of the talk earlier on, design is the process of. Generate and test and statement. So could you kind of qualify that?
So there are a lot of ways. The fundamental question is okay, I'm given a design task, how do I approach it? Mm. And when I teach this stuff, I ask people and they say, you sit down and you read the requirements and you start to think essentially the old kind of thinking about how do they a group together. And there is a community, an academic community primarily, that thinks about design as a process of making decisions. And so they focus on, okay, what decisions are made, what's the rationale for those decisions, what's the sequence of those decisions, there are a number of questions that follow from that view. And to me, that begged the issue of where do the decisions come from, and what decisions you want to make. And so there's a very old way of thinking about design as generate and test. And if you apply that to software, that gives you very specific kinds of questions. It gives you the question of where did the initial thing you're going to generate come from? Mm-hmm. How do you test it? How do you take the results of the test, feed it back, and come up with another hypothesis in terms of what the generation is going to be? And so the fun part of the talk that I gave, the utility tree and the quality mm-hmm. attribute stuff's pretty old work, but the generate and test is relatively recent. And the fun part of that kind of was there are natural ways that people think about things and that they approach a problem. And one way, they actually was in the UK, I asked, somebody said, well, we use prior art. You know, so that's where the initial hypothesis comes from, is, I have a system that I built that or somebody else built that's kind of what I want. I'll use that as the basis. And so there's the notion of where the initial hypothesis come from. There are a set of test cases that come from thinking about which quality attribute scenarios are important to the business and which ones are important to the design. And then there are another set of sort of test cases that come from thinking about various perspectives on the architecture, the static perspective, the dynamic perspective, and so on. So you get a bunch of test cases, you apply that to your hypothesis, and you come up with a list of shortcomings of the current design. And these shortcomings are essentially things that design doesn't do in terms of responsibilities, so it doesn't. I'm trying to avoid the word functionality here. So it doesn't do this, and so that's on the list that it needs to do. And in terms of quality attributes, it is deficient in these particular quality attributes. And then we have another theory that's based on what are called architectural tactics that enable you to improve the behavior of the design with respect to particular quality attributes. And so taking the results of the testing procedure and finding deficiencies, well, if you have a responsibility, you need to add it. That's pretty straightforward. And if you have a quality attribute problem, you apply one of the tactics or more of the tactics, and that helps you with that particular quality attribute. It doesn't help you with the trade-off problems. And so you generate another hypothesis, and you have to go through the process again. And typically what happens is you run out of budget before the system gets perfect.
Well, that's a good point. And I guess where my mind was going was towards the world of agile software development. And historically in agile, non-functional requirements have had an issue of getting onto the agenda. How do you maintain architectural control within an agile project? Now, agile groups are resolving that in many different ways. I'm just wondering, how well do you think that the ideas that you're talking about here, how well do they work in that sort of agile environment?
Well, there's at this point, I think it's a myth that agile and architecture are incompatible.
Well, yeah, okay.
I mean, some of the earlier proponents of agile it wasn't my fault. They were responsible for creating the myth. And fundamentally, that's because when they sat down, they sat down with the existing systems. Their normal engagement model was 6 months, and we're going to build a system, and it's going to be obsolete in 6 months. That was the initial engagement. And so we don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about the design process, and especially if we're starting with something we know how to do. Over time, as the agile movement has matured, that deals with one specific set of circumstances, but it isn't generally applicable to a lot of other environments. And so the approach I like is kind of the risk-driven approach. I'm just reading a book by George Fairbanks. It hasn't been published yet, but he advocates the risk-driven approach, which is, figure out what you're going to worry about, and then worry about it. And if the worrying about it, it takes the form of coming up with a design to deal with that particular issue, then it does, and if it doesn't, then it doesn't.
And that's, that brings me back to the tree, the
utility tree.
And, yeah. And what was really neat there was just, you know, the measurement of high, medium, low against, was it a measure of business value to the importance? I think this ties to the risk
that you just talked about.
And how pervasive that requirement is across the system as a whole. And I thought that, just that alone, that simple quantification model, you said it was quite an old idea. It's been out there a while. But I guess if it was put in context of the risk type element, maybe there's quite a sort of a good measure or approach.
You know? It's an effective, so the utility tree is an effective tool. Just because it's old doesn't mean
it's for sure.
Especially, you know, these days I feel that way.
Somebody said, some person the other day just said, an architect was talking to them and basically said, oh, I know your future. He said, what a silly thing to say. And I thought, well, actually, what he's saying is he's seen what you're going to end up doing.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
mistakes you're going to make, because
you
repeat them. So absolutely. I think there's a lot we can learn from looking back in terms of architectural archaeology in practice. It's how to make that current and consumable. Because I think, if anything, I had a concern with the talk today. It seemed quite overwhelming to me that how would I pick this up and use it very quickly? And if there was one way you were going to get me into taking some of these approaches seriously and practicing them, what would be your advice? How to get involved but not have to read the history of architecting to find out how?
Well, so...
Part of the shortcut generation, you know. I
have two answers to that.
Great.
One is that we invented... You know, lots of this stuff. You can invent it too.
So there's no problem with reinvention, right?
I don't have a problem with reinvention. Yeah, I mean, you know, the main problem I have with reinvention is when you reinvent something, you give it a new name, and then it becomes a fad, and then you get into this religious wars. Well, we used to do that.
Yes.
You know, the utility tree is a particularly simple concept. Essentially, it says enumerate your quality attribute requirements. You know, there's an organization scheme for that. And decide how important they are to the business, and then decide how pervasive they are architecturally, and take the ones that are both.
I mean, that's simple.
So I guess if I were going to give advice to somebody as the best way to get into this, the kind of thinking, I would go with the way that I got into it, which is the architectural analysis perspective. So if you have the opportunity to review somebody's architecture, make them give you concrete scenarios that reflect the business goals. B, look at the presentation they give you of the, make them give you a presentation of the architecture in half an hour or less, which will drive them to focus on the important things. And look at those and ask yourself what are they trying to achieve with those things. And then another response is, in our book we have a number of case studies where we do exactly that. So we talk about things like flight simulators and particular case studies we have, but anyway, we talk about a bunch of different systems. For each system, we say, okay, what were the most important qualities and how did they achieve them? And so you look at the design and you ask yourself, what are they trying to achieve with that? And it's very much a process of reflection. And you can have a discussion with the architect, you know, am I right? View it as a test. And did you think of this? And the answer will be yes or no. And is that important, this thing that I asked you to think about? And so I think the best way to get into that sort of process is through the analysis process. Now, that's not exactly archaeology, but it is building off of the systems that people have built. I mean, by and large, there are a tremendous number of successful systems out there. So if you look at the design of one and ask yourself, what were they trying to achieve? How did their goals change over time? Because there's always a time element in this. And then how did they go about achieving that? And that'll give you some insight and some understanding of how to think about the things.
Right.
And then you can always take the SEI courses too.
Well, why not? That's right. Fantastic. So I'll put a link onto the book at the end of the
film. Yeah, and also into the curriculum.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do the SEI pitch. Yeah, I'm not that fond of the courses anymore. I mean, you know, they were fun for a while, but you end up teaching more than you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's important. So thanks, Len.
Sure.
Thanks for your time, and very interesting sort of topic. And I'll certainly let you know where I put this up on the web and,
good.
And how I share it out. So thanks again.
Mm-hmm.
Meow.